This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
And good afternoon, everyone. Well, by now you may have heard the story on VOCM News and on Opaline yesterday. The future of Thrive's Blue Door program, which helps people who want to exit the sex trade, may be in jeopardy once its federal support comes to an end. The five-year contract is nearing completion, and it's hoped that the provincial government may be able to pick up the nearly $500,000 a year needed to continue the program. We'll hear to talk more about Thrive, what it does, and the programs it provides is Executive Director Angela Crockwell. Hello.
Hello, and thanks for having me on.
Well, no problem. And I did hear you on Open Line yesterday, and it was a fascinating conversation. I said to myself, well, there's a lot more here that could justify a full hour's conversation. The first question, I suppose, is what is Thrive and what does it do?
Yeah, sure. So we are a charitable organization located here in St. John's. We have been in operation just over 20 years, and most of our programs and services that we have developed over the course of that time were brought about because we identified kind of key gaps in services and really wanted to add as much value to the community as we possibly can and really address some of those critical gaps that we identified. So some of our programs include Street Reach, so we're the only street-based outreach service in the city, and again, recognize that there was a real need to have people street-level connecting with vulnerable populations. So through that program, we have a staff team, but also 50-plus volunteers, and every week we hit the streets and connect with people. We also operate a drop-in center 5 days a week at our main location at Thrive, and we have staff who really help people address some of the concerning issues that they're dealing with, and that could be mental health, substance use or abuse, housing are really the issues that float to the top for that program. We also offer a alternative education program for young people who were not successful in the education system. And again, started that program because we recognized there was no literacy and numeracy support for people under the age of 18. So we operate that program. It includes foundational literacy, numeracy, through to GED, which is the general education diploma, preparation and testing. And so we're the only GED prep and testing center in the province. And we support about 100 young people every year through that program and really are able to help them kind of move forward once they have that foundational education piece. And then the other one that we're going to talk most about today is around sexual exploitation. So we have a coalition of community partners that have been working together for over a decade to really try to address sexual exploitation, particularly of young people in our province. And through that work, we're able to identify the real need for a program such as Blue Door. So that one is specifically for people who have the experience of exploitation or trafficking and really need some intensive support to help them transition from that experience.
Are all these issues and programs interconnected?
They really are. I always say to the staff team, even though we have people working in different program areas, they all overlap. So when we think about like our Street Reach program that is certainly supporting people around housing and substance use and mental health issues, that overlaps with the work that Blue Door is doing. And for our education program, again, many of the people that we identified for Blue Door and have certainly supported lots of young people over the course of that program who had the experience of sexual exploitation. And it really overlaps, and we're all here every day really doing the same work, just our focus or expertise is slightly different.
It might be outside of your realm, but I'm fascinated with this educational component. Are learning difficulties or disabilities, sort of a risk factor, if you will, in people sort of dropping out of the school system and finding themselves trying to find a way?
Yes, absolutely. So in our education program, we certainly identify that there are a lot of young people with learning differences and learning disabilities that really need some specialized support. Incredibly bright and capable people with the right programming and interventions have been incredibly successful. And it really does overlap in terms of the vulnerability for exploitation. We know that young people who leave school early are at an increased risk for a whole bunch of things, and exploitation could certainly be one of those.
My guest today on Target is Angela Crockwell, the Executive Director of Thrive here in St. John's. We'll be back right after this.
Weekday mornings from 5:30 to 9. Jumpstart your day with Jerry Lynn Mackey and Ben Murphy. Newsmakers, traffic, weather, and more during your VOCM morning show.
My guest today is the Executive Director of Thrive, Angela Crockwell. And Angela, you've been explaining a little bit about what Thrive is and some of the things that it does. How long has it been in operation?
So we have been in operation just over 20 years. We're at our annual general meeting in September. That was the launch of our 20th anniversary.
You mentioned it's a charitable organization. How is it typically funded?
So we receive funding from a number of sources. Our main source of funding would be the provincial government, but we also do receive funding, for example, with the Blue Door, we've received funding from the federal government. The City of St. John's is a supporter, and we also have a number of amazing individual and corporate sponsors of many of the initiatives that we offer.
How many people seek out your services?
So throughout the course of a year, we would typically see somewhere between 500 and 600 individuals through our programming.
That's quite extraordinary. Is that yearly?
Yeah. And so we typically, and many people who we support, they don't necessarily change over every year. So again, say with the Blue Door program, people can stay in that program for as long as they need. So we would be supporting people sometimes for multiple years. But we've certainly noticed an increase in the number of new people who are connecting with our services on every quarter. The reports are we've seen 30, 40, 50 new people in the last 3 months that we had never had contact with previously. So the need is really significant.
Wow. So a big uptick in the last couple of months.
Yes, absolutely. And, I think when we looked at the data, even from the experience of obviously in the last 18 months over, COVID, the demand really increased for all of our services. And we've seen significant pressure on our organization to really try to meet those needs.
To what do you attribute that? Is it, sort of a post-COVID kind of things have built up? Things were kind of quiet, ostensibly on the surface, we'll say they're quiet, if you know what I mean. But things have been a little bit quiet lately, and maybe this is that post-COVID people coming out and finally coming forward, or what's happening?
Yeah, I think there were there's a number of factors. So one was throughout the pandemic, while a lot of services were really reducing their ability to connect with people in person, Thrive was very committed to making sure everybody who needed our services could at least come and ring the doorbell and see a human face. So I think that constant human connection that we were able to provide throughout the pandemic was very appealing to people who were so isolated. And so I think we built a lot of connections that way. But also, you're right, I mean, this pandemic has certainly impacted people in a number of ways and has put a lot of pressure on people around mental health, around housing stability. A lot of people were living in violent situations for people who were experiencing sexual exploitation, that isolation was extremely challenging. And so as things opened up, people were able to reconnect and reach out. And I actually think we will see that continue over the next couple of years.
Do people typically seek you out independently? Are they funneled to you through other organizations or agencies? How does that typically work?
Yeah, so we will take referrals from all sources, and we do get a lot of referrals from community partners or government services or, you know, the school system or the court system. But I would say the vast majority of people who connect with our program, and certainly the Blue Door program, are self-referrals. So, again, it's a really interesting observation that we've noted over the past number of years. The number of self-referrals we're seeing has really increased.
Now, you've mentioned Blue Door a few times. So what is the Blue Door program and what does it do?
Yeah, so it's a program that was designed specifically for folks who had experienced sexual exploitation or human trafficking and or had engaged in consensual sex work and identified that they really did not want to be engaged in that activity and needed some intensive supports to help them leave, exit, transition. So we provide full wraparound supports to people to help them address whatever the barriers or challenges are for them in their lives, and that would be really helpful in terms of helping them make those transitions. And we also focus a lot on education and employment in that program, recognizing that lots of the people that we're supporting had really precarious employment histories or no employment history, did not have high school or high school equivalency. So we really wanted to help support them around those employment and education pieces as well.
What are some of those difficulties or barriers for people who want to exit the sex trade or cases of sexual exploitation?
Yeah, it's honestly, the issues are very broad, and it really depends on people's individual experiences and what that looked like for them. But typically, I would say for most of the people that we're supporting, mental health is a huge issue. When they've been exploited, we often see a lot of impacts on people's mental health and certainly see some serious diagnosis of PTSD from that experience. A lot of people, housing has been a real challenge, and we know that 50% of the people that we supported in Blue Door had experienced homelessness, and then there's another group that are really precariously housed. And lots of exposure to violence and relationship conflicts. We often see people who have also a lot of physical health issues. So if they were not able to access medical services through the experience of being exploited, then they could have some real complications around physical health issues that we've been able to help support people with. And again, lack of education, lack of employment is also significant issues that we've seen. And then there's the very basic stuff like food security and access to transportation and access to like technology, like a cell phone to be able to keep yourself safe and stay connected with people.
Do many people require continuing services? So even once they, meet some success in getting to a place that they'd rather be?
Yeah, so the best practice is really allowing people to have access to the supports and services for the duration that really works best for them. So when we developed Blue Door, we intentionally did not put a time limit like you would get, you know, 6 months or 1 year of service. For some people, that is all they need, is a place to come and find supports and stability and you know, some therapeutic services, get them housed, and they can be well on their way and do fine. And for other people, if they have a lot of complicating factors, then they really need that long-term intervention. And that's what we've heard very clearly from survivors, is do not place time limits on us, because for some people, it's a lot to unpack, and people might do exceptionally well for a little while, and then something might happen in their lives that really can trigger a little bit of a reset, and they need more support again.
So I guess monitoring, but follow-up is so important.
It absolutely is, and even when people have left our program, they always know that they can reach back. So, you know, and we see that all the time, and some of it is they're coming back to really celebrate successes around, I just graduated, you know, high school, or I just graduated from post-secondary, or I got a job, or I'm starting a family. And for some people, it is, you know, I was doing really well, and now I'm struggling again, and I need support again. And again, we did see that in COVID for people who were doing, like, were in recovery around some of their substance uses. The stress of COVID really was challenging for some people.
I imagine there's a lot of trust issues there. Do you help to form and build that trust and those relationships that might not normally happen because of that lack of trust?
Yeah, the trust and relationship building piece is really the foundation for the work we do. And you know, we always say, until that trust and relationship exists, it's really, really challenging to do the work. And for people who have, again, been exploited, their trust has obviously been violated, and most times the person who has been doing the exploitation is somebody who was in their lives and somebody that they deeply trusted. So they have had the experience of being let down numerous times by people they trusted. So that is really a huge foundational piece to help people work through. And again, I think one of the things that I've learned over the years is, you know, even when we are being very kind to people and very nice and very supportive for people who've been exploited, that can be a red flag for them, because they don't trust it, because they've trusted other people who were very kind and, you know, very nice and supportive of them. And so there's always this thing sometimes in the back of people's minds is, what do you want? What was the end game here? So that trust piece is really essential.
Oh, absolutely. And we can talk a little bit about that when we come back after the break. My guest today is the executive director of Thrive, Angela Crockwell. We'll be back right after this.
Every Saturday is perfect for a night at the cabin. The Cabin Party with Brian O'Connell. Saturday night starting at 7 p.m. on VOCM.
My guest today is the executive director of Thrive, Angela Crockwell. And of the many programs that Thrive is involved in, one of them is the Blue Door program. And you had already expressed on VOCM some concerns about the future of that program as it deals with sexual exploitation and human trafficking. But what is exactly sexual exploitation and human trafficking?
For human trafficking, it really involves a third person who is using force or coercion, and it's the transportation or confinement of an individual. So that third party is really exerting some type of control over somebody to engage in sexual acts. Human trafficking also includes labor trafficking, but for Blue Door, we're specifically looking at the sexual piece. And that person would then usually take all the money and profits from the earnings of that. In terms of exploitation, there doesn't necessarily need to be a third party involved. So when we think about things like if someone's experiencing homelessness and a friend or a connection says to that person, I will let you sleep on my couch, but in order to do that, you have to, again, provide some type of sexual service for me. That's an exploitive situation because they're using the vulnerability of that young person's precarious housing in order to gain sexual access to the person. So that's really the difference. The other thing that I think is important for people to understand around human trafficking is it doesn't have to cross provincial borders or international borders. I think a lot of the imagery we see around human trafficking, again, is this idea of people in cages and chains and that kind of thing. You don't have to move. So if you have a person who is forcing you into some type of sexual activity here in St. John's, you don't ever have to leave St. John's and you would be considered a victim of human trafficking.
Does it often, these third-party scenarios involving human trafficking, does it often involve organized crime?
There's certainly a lot of data to back that up, that organized crime is connected to this, and it can be, unfortunately, very profitable. A lot of the people that we see is locally not so much connected to organized crime. It's more generally people that they trusted. Sometimes it is family members. So we haven't seen the significant connection to organized crime that I think more nationally and internationally people are identifying.
Is it a prominent issue?
It really is, and I think one of the challenges that we often face is that public awareness and understanding that this is a significant issue. And again, I'm sure lots of people listening today are thinking to themselves, I had no idea that this was even happening in our province. But again, we have had, over the course of the 5 years we were operating Blue Door, 80 people who have reached out for services. We have maintained a wait list from almost day one of when we opened the doors. And when I think about, again, people coming forward and asking for support around this, we know there's it would be in some ways, a small percentage of people who would reach out because there's lots of stigma and shame for people. So I think those 80 people probably represent, 500 or 600 people that have had that experience.
It seems to me that, or it strikes me as you're talking, you spoke previously about PTSD and how some of the people that you've been dealing with suffer PTSD, whether they know it or not. And I'm thinking in terms of some of the things that you said, this hypervigilance or lack of trust. People go into a certain survival mode. It's all about self-preservation, even though the very issues that they're dealing with is probably harming them. But it's about getting through to the next day, making sure you've got enough money to put food in your belly and all those basic common needs. And it seems that all points back to economic inequities, poverty, those kinds of things. Do you find it all sort of comes back there?
Poverty is such a concerning issue, and it really does increase people's vulnerability. And as you said, this is a very complicated issue, and it's not one thing that puts people at risk, and there's not one thing that we can do to really address this issue. It has to be that multi-pronged approach. This is about misogyny. This is about patriarchy. This is about poverty, this is about social exclusion. All of those factors really impact people, and so it's really important that if we're doing responses that they have to be holistic. We can't just address one issue because that won't be really enough.
Indeed, and mental health and addictions and everything else that comes with it. And as you said, educational needs. So what do people who are seeking out your services want and need?
Yeah, so we have heard very clearly from the people that we support around their needs, and we actually engaged them in a national study to look at what were some of the best practices to really help people who want to leave. Again, really good mental health and substance use treatments that are really understanding of this experience and understanding of trauma is really important to people. And also harm reduction was something that people talked about a lot. So if somebody wants help to address, say, substance use, like to be able to even get access to the program, if you've got to have two or three or a month of sobriety under your belt, that's really challenging for people. So they talked about the need to have those, the services that we do, really harm reduction. People talked a lot about, again, being able to access just very basic needs, and that was really important because for many people who are exploited, their housing is tied to that. Their finances are tied to that. How they feed themselves is tied to that. So if they leave, they often have no access to financial resources. So they need services that are going to help them with basic food, security issues and transportation, and those just kind of immediate needs. They also talked a lot around peer support and relationships amongst peers as rebuilding those social connections, because again, if you leave that, those are often where all your social connections were. So a program that really helps reconnect those peer relationships outside of the sex trade was really important. And housing, stable housing, is so important for all of us to have a safe, stable place to live. Without that, people can really, really be put at risk.
Well, indeed. And I remember having guests in on a show talking about the importance of a safe place to sleep, you know, and we take those things for granted, how important a good night's sleep is, where you feel comfortable and safe. You can put your head down and close your eyes and not have to worry about anything until you wake up in the morning. And for many of us, that's a given. But for a lot of people, it's not.
Absolutely. And it is really, it's such a crucial part. So we have done a lot of work in this program and with our community partners around helping ensure people have access to as reasonably safe and affordable housing. That is a huge challenge in this city. But we have certainly been successful at getting people housed and helping them maintain that housing because it really is a critical piece for people.
And I want to talk a little bit about funding and some of the challenges you're facing in the near future when we come back after the break. My guest today on Target is the executive director of Thrive, Angela Crockwell, who Thrive, of course, offers a number of programs for people, including the Blue Door program. And there is some, I guess, concern about the future of that program. We'll come back and talk about that right after this.
Weekdays on VOCM, it's Open Line with your host, Patty Daly. Join the conversation each morning from 9 a.m. to noon on your VOCM. We get people talking.
My guest on Target today is the executive director of Thrive, Angela Crockwell, and one of the many programs they provide is the Blue Door program. And this is a program that helps people who want to exit the sex trade to, I guess, find a way forward. Can the Blue Door program exist without government support?
It really cannot. It's essential to have stable, long-term funding to make sure that we have the resources we need, we have the skill level within our staff team to be able to do this work well, and we cannot rely on just our, you know, general community to be funding this. I think there's an obligation on behalf of the survivors to make sure that this is appropriately and adequately funded.
So how is it currently funded? And it's, I presume it's coming to an end. Will it not be renewed?
So it's currently funded from the federal government under Public Safety Canada. And so they have what they consider like program or project funding. They provide a maximum of 5 years. That's their funding agreement, and that's the most that they can provide to agencies such as ours doing this work. Even though we can clearly demonstrate the positive outcomes and impacts, they have no capacity within the funding stream to be able to extend that, which is unfortunate. But we knew 5 years ago that, you know, February 2022 would be the end of that funding stream, and have really been throughout the 5 years talking to government and making the provincial government and making them aware of this February deadline, and having those conversations that we would be seeking the provincial government support for this. I mean, the federal government has invested over $2 million to really lay this foundation and for us to be able to prove the work that we're doing, both from the need exists, but also prove the effectiveness of what we're doing. And I think it's incumbent upon the provincial government to then say, okay, the federal government has done this initial investment, and we need to also step up and make sure this is sustained.
Do you think you've proven that effectiveness?
I think without a doubt we have proven the effectiveness of this program and have been able to clearly demonstrate to the provincial government those outcomes from, you know, everything from the number of people that we have supported to be stably housed. Again, you know, how much it costs the provincial government to have people in our shelter system is extensive. The number of people who have transitioned off of the income support system and are now working and paying taxes, the number of people who have received substance use treatment and are in recovery. I don't necessarily think of this as a dollars and cents issue, but again, you know, the number of people that are not accessing emergency care anymore at our hospitals. So we've been able to really clearly demonstrate that. And I will say, through our conversations with the provincial government, everybody has been able to understand that and understand the value of the work that we're doing and the positive impacts. What has not happened is a commitment to provide any financial resources to make sure it's sustained.
So how much does Ottawa provide right now?
So I would say on average, because every year the budget's slightly different, but on average it's $450,000. And I recognize that's not a small number. We have asked the provincial government for slightly less than that at $417,000, because we have a lot of infrastructure already put in place and, you know, the resources that staff needed in terms of setup and startup and that kind of thing. So that's our ask of the provincial government right now.
Do you think the province can pick up those pieces? Have they signaled that they can?
We have not had that signal from the provincial government. We've had, again, we have certainly had positive conversations and an acknowledgement of the importance of the work. I do understand that, you know, this province is not flush with cash, but I also think when we're talking about people who have been victimized or are survivors of sexual exploitation, it is not unreasonable to ask the government of Newfoundland and Labrador to invest $400,000 in a budget to make sure that people have access to the appropriate supports and services. I think it's about making decisions around where we're going to put in investments. We would not, again, when you think about people who experience domestic violence or sexual assault, there's a recognition that there needs to be specialized programs and services for people who've had that experience. And we've made that conscious decision that we're going to make those investments for folks who've had those experiences. I call on the government of Newfoundland and Labrador to commit to doing the exact same thing for folks who've experienced exploitation and trafficking.
So what specifically is that money used for? What does it go towards? A salary, program development, supports? How does it work?
So the biggest piece of that budget is staffing. So we have right now a staff team of 5 people, and it is really important that we are able to hire people who have expertise and a high degree of competency. So, all of our staff are extremely well trained, extremely well educated, and that's really important. This is not a job where, if you have limited work experience or limited skill set in supporting incredibly complex individuals and issues, that's really the backbone of the work we're doing, is staff being highly skilled. So that's the biggest part of the budget, is making sure we have, we can pay and keep and retain staff who are extremely skilled. Then, the other parts of the budget are things like supporting people with transportation. We have like an outreach budget when people are making application to go to, say, post-secondary, and there's a $30 fee to be able to put in that application. We can cover that cost and take away those barriers. We have a food budget. We meet as a group every week and we cook a meal. So those kinds of things, but the vast majority is the staffing piece, and that's really what makes the difference of that program being successful, is having, again, those highly skilled, competent people.
Are there alternatives if, this $417,000 ask doesn't come to fruition?
Oh, I've thought about what are we going to do if we don't secure the funding? Where do we help people transition to? We have not been able to identify capacity in the community to pick up any of this slack. There's certainly no other program with this specialized focus. Are there places in the community that could do some support around housing? Yeah, sure. There's obviously mental health and addiction services that we could do some connections to. But in terms of really a safe place where people can go and get all of those needs met, it does not exist. And we know how frustrating it is for people who are really trying to get their needs met. If they got to go knock on another 20 or 30 doors, get a piece here and a piece here and a piece here, that's really not an effective way to be supporting people.
And I would imagine if that funding is secured, you're looking for, a commitment of a certain number of years.
Yes, and we recognize that the provincial government generally does one-year commitments, and, it would be lovely to have multi-year commitments. That's how most of our staff here work, is with an understanding of year-to-year, but, it would be wonderful for a long-term commitment, but I recognize that's not generally how the provincial government's funding arrangements with community agencies work. So if we got a one-year commitment, once it's in the budget, it's much easier than for the following year. So that's the critical piece for us, is to secure this next 12-month funding.
Have you developed a relationship with the various provincial departments under which you could fall? I suppose there's a couple that come immediately to mind: children, seniors, social development, and of course the Office of Women and Gender Diversity.
Yes, so we have some really good partnerships with a variety of provincial government departments, and we've certainly, over the course, as I mentioned, of this project, we have been meeting with them throughout the 5 years. I think one of the challenges that we have ran into when we first started building those connections, particularly around Blue Door, we knew that, you know, like, politicians might change. So we started at, like, the senior executive levels of, like, assistant deputy ministers and deputy ministers. But again, over the course of the 5 years, people, again, move, have retired. So we feel like we're in this constant, like, rebuild the connection. We have met with folks from the Department of Child, Seniors, Social Development, Justice, and Women and Gender Diversity. So we've been having those conversations throughout the past number of years.
Angela, we've got less than 2 minutes left. Any final thoughts?
You know, I've said this within this organization and as I've been speaking to people about this, and again, I understand the need to make the argument around the finances, but I really strongly feel that there's an ethical obligation that as a society that that we have to people who've been victimized in this way. I also feel really strongly that we need to lift this issue up. It has been one of the more challenging issues that we have tried to get traction on. I think, I'm not sure if it's people don't want to acknowledge that this is happening or if just the lack of awareness or the disbelief, but I think the government's investment in this would also send a clear message to the people who've been victimized that we see you, we know you're out there, and we care about what happens to you, and we're willing to make those investments. And I think that message is also critically important because a lot of people feel like society as a whole has really turned a blind eye to their experience.
Angela Crockwell, Executive Director of Thrive, I appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you very much. Keep us up to date.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And we'll be back tomorrow for another edition of On Target. Do join us then, and thanks for listening.